From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
His first week in office, Donald Trump wasted no time revisiting some of his most controversial campaign promises, from forging ahead with plans to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border to introducing restrictions aimed at Muslim immigrants, moves that have generated strong reactions from supporters and critics. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast, in for Josh Barrow. On the right, we have Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review. On the left, we have Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic. Welcome, everyone. So much has happened this week that it would be impossible for us to cover it all, but I feel like we've got to start with the wall and the fallout from the wall. The new president announced plans to move forward with building a wall along our border with Mexico. The White House also announced plans to pay for it with a 20% tariff on Mexican imports. Now, every analysis I've seen from experts from the Council on Foreign Relations and others indicates that such a tariff would ultimately hurt more Americans than helps because we import so many items from Mexico and the cost of goods would just go up and hurt American consumers. But Rich, I want to raise something with you. Pew also released a poll not too long ago that found that 77% of Americans view stopping people from overstaying visas as important, 58% view increasing deportations as important. Only 39% view building a wall as somewhat important. So why is this president expending so much of his political capital, his first week, on this wall? And do you think it's actually even going to happen?
Well, it was a key promise of his, so he had to act, and it's already been authorized by Congress, I believe, in 2006. It's just never actually built, and I don't think we'll see the wall completed. I do think we'll see more structure on the border, which is helpful, but not the main thing. I mean, the main thing is really interior enforcement at the point of employment, and also you need a working exit entry visa system because 50% or maybe more now of illegal immigration is visa overstayers. Now, the other part of the Trump promise, obviously, is that Mexico is going to pay for the wall, which is extremely difficult to effect. Sean Spicer floated this 20% tariff, which seems to actually have been a reference to the Paul Ryan border tax element of his tax reform plan, which gets hideously complicated once you look at it. It makes it very dubious that you could use that to make Mexico pay for the wall. And I'm a hardliner on immigration, as listeners to the show know, but I don't think there's any upside in humiliating the Mexicans, because Trump may think he's getting leverage, but actually when you humiliate people and stomp all over their honor, you don't get a rational and constructive response usually. So I think that's a mistake.
To your point, David, what a difference a week makes. Days ago, President Peña Nieto said of upcoming negotiations with the U.S., neither confrontation nor submission, dialogue is the solution. But as of right now, it doesn't look like much dialogue is going to happen because he canceled his scheduled meeting with the White House. Can you start by telling us what impact you think Donald Trump's first week as president and specifically the policies he's introduced this first week have had on how world leaders view us?
During the transition, I wrote, in this administration, the controversies exist to distract you from the scandals. Mm. As you said, there's a lot that happened this week. I would like to draw attention to something that didn't get enough attention, which is that Trump Hotels announced a plan to triple the number of locations they have in the United States, and Trump's country club or club in Florida doubled its initiation fee, selling access to the president. The Trump brand is not a popular high-end brand. The Trump Hotels are not a success. So what changed to suddenly triple the demand for the Trump Hotel brand? Only the abuse of political office for business gain. Trump talks about the wall because, as Rich says, I'm an immigration hardliner. All immigration hardliners agree the wall is like your 19th priority. In fact, it's probably counterproductive to the things you really want to do. But it's inflammatory, and it gets people excited, and it distracts from the corruption.
Do you believe he ran for office just to sell this access?
Yes.
Katrina, you were going to happen?
I'm not sure I believe that, though. He walked into office a walking conflict of interest in violation of the Constitution, the Emoluments Clause, which we're now all experts on, and the Stock Act. But I think David is absolutely right that distraction has been Donald Trump's modus operandi. I think we're witnessing a permanent campaign with Steve Bannon, the nationalist White House advisor, at Trump's side. It's about disruption. It's about distraction. And in this case, you know, we've seen Trump's fixation with crowd size, the war on the media, calculated strategy to not only incite his base, but to distract and delegitimize institutions that might report inconvenient or damaging facts about the president is very strategic for an administration that has made a slew of impossible promises and takes office amid a cloud of ethics concerns and potential scandals. What struck me is, you know, we're looking at ideological jellyfish here, or deficit jellyfish. You got Paul Ryan and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who had a press briefing the other day in announced cavalierly that Congress would find some $15 billion to pay for the border wall. It reminds me of what Dick Cheney, I think, said at a certain point in the Bush administration. Deficits don't matter. Well, they seem to have been the orthodoxy of these Republicans for many, many decades. But they're scrambling to get on the Trump bandwagon. And with the exception of the wall, I will say, though, Trump's, many of his policies are pretty orthodox Republican. Cut corporate taxes, cut taxes on the highest, wealthiest, and deregulation of everything, from justice to air and water.
Blowing up the world's trading system and unilaterally making concessions to Russia are not Republican orthodoxy, and those have also been high points of the week.
I will say, but his impulsive use of Twitter to make foreign policy statements, David, I think would unsettle you as well as anyone. I mean, he's turning American foreign policy diplomacy into a series of personal relationships unguided by strategy or forethought, not to use those two terms, in close proximity with Trump. So I do think there is a danger of blowing up a lot. But there are a lot of Republicans clambering on board, and we shall see.
But I want to ask two follow-ups. I mean, something interesting that you just said, David, is how this is a strategy, right, to distract with the real non-issues, to get us not focused on the things that we really should be focused on. But I'm sure you all read the same articles I've read this week about the leaks coming from inside the White House about how difficult he is to serve as a president, in part because according to these sources from inside the White House, he was genuinely obsessed with the crowd size issue. Like, I wonder if we're giving him too much credit that it's all a strategy to get us looking one way at the crowd size issue.
Well, you don't have to believe he's strategic to believe that he's canny. I mean, obviously, he's got these raging ego needs. Mm-hmm. But one of the ways he salves his raging ego needs is by amassing a giant fortune. That's one of the metrics of reassurance.
Or looking like he has.
Well, until now, he's had to look like he could only have the simulacrum of a giant fortune. Now he's about to get a big one. I think that's one of the reasons he admires Vladimir Putin so much, is Putin has demonstrated how you use political power to become one of the richest men in the world, on the planet. And I think that if Donald Trump gets the 8 years that Kellyanne Conway has been talking about this week, I have no doubt that Donald Trump will be in the top 10 list of richest men on the planet. He's probably not in the top 100,000 list right now.
I think Trump's totally unsubstantiated insistence to congressional leaders that millions of illegal votes had been cast in November, costing him the popular vote, reveals the extraordinary insecurity about his mandate, about his legitimacy as president.
Among media and among voters. I wanted to move on, though, to something else that happened that I feel like we have to talk about, which is he's meeting with the Prime Minister, Theresa May. I want to start with you, Katrina, by asking about something. Nigel Farage made a, quote, joke where he said, come and schmooze Theresa, don't touch her for goodness sake. I didn't find that particularly funny because it was a nod to him bragging about putting his hands on women. I wanted to note, do you have concerns, Katrina, about his ability to treat female world leaders with the respect needed and deserved?
I have concerns about Donald Trump's ability to treat all world leaders with the respect they deserve. So, you know, he clearly finds solace in the guy factor, the network of guys. David spoke of Putin. You know, even the Philippines leader, I think, Duterte, who's a killer, he's spoken highly of, and Erdogan. I was just saying to Rich, though, before we began the broadcast, you know, there's this special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K., Theresa May she's bringing over the Scottish cup. I can't quite pronounce it, a quaich or a quaich, which is a two-handled cup to drink Scottish whiskey from. That's not going to go. I mean, someone needs to brief her about Donald Trump as a teetotaler. The main thing Donald Trump has learned from the British, I think, is Aaron Banks, who doesn't get enough attention, UKIP's main financier, who advised Trump a few weeks ago that facts are white noise, emotions matter. And I think that's probably an animating impulse of this administration heretofore and moving forward.
Well, it's worth noting that Theresa May was a critic of his. She wasn't quite as critical as David Cameron, who, you know, called him a few choice words and made it sound like he wouldn't meet with him. But she has been a critic. I'm sorry, Rich, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I was just going to come back to the various sideline controversies. I don't think this is a part of a distraction strategy on the part of Donald Trump. I think it's entirely sincere. He lives in this little shame honor world where there are certain things that really undermine his sense of self and sense of honor, and they have to do with TV ratings, book sales, poll numbers, crowd size, number of popular votes, and height of buildings. And anything that impinges on those, he's extremely defensive about, and he's made a career, a successful one, in New York City's tabloid world by exaggerating all those kinds of numbers and creating his own private reality, which has become second nature to him. And, you know, the debate over the crowd size and the inauguration ultimately doesn't matter. The foolishness about the illegal votes doesn't really matter so much. The worry has to be that at some point, this kind of sub-rational impulse on the part of Trump spills over into serious affairs of state. And that's when they become, you know, serious as a heart attack.
And not just matters of state, but how they spill over into the damage done to people. People in this country, whether it's the handling of Obamacare, whether it's the handling of tax cuts, whether it's the fact that, in fact, this tariff discussion, that could well hit hard the very Trump supporters
right.
who supported him. So I think there are a whole set of serious policy implications cascading forward soon that need to be fixed on, and not just the character. I mean, in fact, one of the reasons I think Hillary Clinton lost the election was that there was so much about Donald Trump's character, and there wasn't enough of her speaking confidently about what she was for. So we are at risk in the media, it seems to me, if we don't do the fearless reporting about the impact of his policies but fix too much, though it's legitimate to worry about the connection between character and policy, but fixate too much on the character.
But this is where we join what Katrina and Rick are saying together in a way that is really alarming. So Donald Trump's politics of ego and dominance, as Rich nicely called them, bump into the reality of the world that the United States built after 1945. The global trading system is a system of rules. And it's a system of rules in which the strongest country in the world agreed to be bound, not to be an imperialist, but to be bound, so that Singapore and Denmark have the same rights in that system as the mighty United States. Donald Trump, by canceling TPP and now by blowing up NAFTA, and with it the whole World Trade Organization, is striking at the heart of that American achievement.
Let us know what you think about the Trump administration's first week so far on our Facebook page or our Twitter account at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, more on Donald Trump's first week. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest today is David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic. We were talking about world leaders earlier and specifically how we're viewed in the world. I wanted to reference something that a former world leader, so to speak, a former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright tweeted. I was raised Catholic, became Episcopalian, and found out later my family was Jewish. I stand ready to register as Muslim in solidarity. That was in response to reports this week about some of the Trump administration's plans to place restrictions on immigrants, specifically blocking refugee admissions from Syria indefinitely, suspending refugee admissions from all countries for 120 days. Rich, I'd like to start with you. You know, during the campaign, there was bipartisan criticism of these planned proposals. Do you sense that there will still be bipartisan opposition, or is the fact that he's been elected president kind of made that less likely?
Yeah, well, you're seeing the Republican Party move in Trump's direction on a lot of this, and there's no way that kind of the upper echelon of the entire Republican Party that denounced his proposal for a temporary Muslim ban when he first raised it in 2016 would speak in similar terms today. And it's just one way that Trump is changing the party. And a lot of this I welcome. I think the party needed to move in a more populist and nationalist direction. And to put it crudely, I think Paul Ryan should be more populist and Donald Trump should be more conservative. And there's a happy middle ground there. I wouldn't have a blanket ban on refugees, but I would tilt strongly towards trying to help these people settle in countries nearby the countries that they have fled so they can actually go back when conditions improve, one, and two, that we're not taking it on ourselves because it's extremely expensive to bring and house people here who have very little ability to make their way of it in a 21st century economy. So it's much more cost effective. You can help bigger numbers if you're doing it overseas, although there's little indication that Trump is actually interested in that alternative.
But let me just ask, Rich, I read your column this week, which was very good. But one of the things that you talked about in terms of his inauguration speech and going in a more populist nationalist direction, but you also said that it was important to do so in a way that was respectful of underrepresented groups. I think you talked about racial diversity, et cetera. And I think there's a lot of fear from people, especially with Bannon in the White House and some of the rhetoric we saw on the campaign trail. What do you think he has done or needs to do so far to make people from groups feel like he is not, a bigot who's simply targeting people who are minorities to get them out of the country, which is the perception among many?
Well, first of all, don't engage in unnecessary high-profile fights with civil rights icons. If they attack the legitimacy of your presidency, this is why you have surrogates. This is why God gave you Kellyanne Conway. Let her engage in those sort of ticky-tacky fights. Two, his nationalism really needs to be enriched by a greater sense of the nation's creed, of respect for its institutions and its history. And that's almost entirely absent. You look at the inaugural address, and it was all about an affinity and loyalty to the American people, rather than, say, the Declaration, the Constitution, et cetera. And three, just don't forget the need to do defensive politics, cultural politics. And this is something Barack Obama thought he really didn't need to do anymore. The Democrats thought they didn't need to do anymore. And Donald Trump certainly needs to do it as a president who's took office this past week with roughly a 40% approval rating, which is a historic low. So he should be concerned with more outreach. And the last point I would make, this kind of working class politics that he represents does have the potential to have some appeal across racial lines. I think, don't quote me exactly on this number, but I think about half of the workers in that carrier plant that were supposedly saved by Donald Trump and Mike Pence's intervention are African American. So we tend to fixate on working class whites, but they're working class Hispanics, obviously, and working class people of all colors and creeds, and Trump should be trying to reach out to them.
David, can I get you to jump in, though, on something else that I really want your expertise on, which is he did generate criticism from his hardcore supporters this week, though, for not moving to deport Dreamers and to looking as though he's going to actually back off of that. Does he get points for that? Do you think that signals that there is some, measure of being reasonable here when it comes to immigration policy?
Well, I'm not sure I would accept your definition of reasonableness on immigration policy, but
specifically on Dreamers.
What a rational immigration restrictionist would do would be to join some kind of steps on behalf of those people who truly came under 12 and can prove it, and who have stayed out of trouble with the law and have met certain other standards, and join that to the other restrictionist measure. So you put in a broaden your appeal to many different constituencies. So you would do the other things that the restrictionists want to do, which is border enforcement, workplace enforcement, tightening up the visa entry-exit system, ending the diversity lottery, making sure that H-1Bs really go to high-skilled people, and reducing the flow of legal immigration from the million a year that we've had since 1990 to the half million a year that we had before. And then you join in with that some kind of amnesty measures. But he doesn't think rationally. I mean, to your question about how does he's not really interested in these issues. And to your question, it's a staple of punditry. People often ask, what does Donald Trump need to do to achieve this or that aim? And I always say, what does Donald Trump need to do to run a 6-minute mile? He's not interested in running a 6-minute mile. And the things he'd have to do, he's not going to do. So he's not going to do those things.
I think
you did call him one of the worst presidents ever, including slave owners, David. So I know
him
you
the,
have
the worst human being ever to enter the presidency.
You know, to pick up
for which
what
I got
Rich
some
said.
Blowback, but I will defend that sentiment.
Okay.
To pick up on what Rich said, I do think, you know, Donald Trump has the opportunity to be more outreaching, but I think what we've seen in these early days, again, this permanent campaign. I venture that he will be known as a disruptive, not a transformational president. And that, I think, he works with fear and loathing. He doesn't work when he's presented with the opportunity, he's spurned it in terms of reaching out. In terms of immigration, Kelly, I think what we're going to see, again, in this arena is that cities and states around this country are already gearing up to confront Donald Trump, to commit their states, cities, to protecting undocumented populations, to be sanctuary cities. The Attorney General of New York has laid out legal steps cities, states will need to take. There will be a battle over funding. Trump has charged ahead talking about defunding those places which do become sanctuary cities. But I think the resistance to these inhumane, wrongly crafted policies that Trump, if they're in fact policies, some of it is spectacle, has laid out, will prompt fierce resistance in the coming months.
Let us know what you think about the new president's immigration policy so far on our Facebook page or our Twitter account at LRCKCRW. I would be remiss before we go if I didn't bring up the Women's March. Donald Trump's presidency began with one march. His first week began with one march, and it's ending with another. Last week, millions of women around the world took to the streets, and the men who support them, many to protest his proposed policies. But this week, hundreds of thousands of people are marching to express support for the pro-life policy agenda he's promised to deliver on. I want to start with you, Rich. Do you believe conservatives are feeling confident? I know Mike Pence, Vice President Pence, is speaking at the March for Life. Are conservatives feeling confident that the president, who was formerly pro-choice, is going to usher in a new era of policies that are friendly to those who oppose abortion?
Yes, definitely. I think it's, you know, more as a matter of coalition politics than conviction. But Donald Trump wouldn't have been elected president if it weren't for the evangelical vote. And most of the evangelical leaders, with some exceptions, got on board reluctantly and with this kind of transactional politics entirely in mind. So maybe this alliance eventually frays, but not in the near term. So you're going to see Trump deliver on pretty much every particular that the pro-life movement wants.
Katrina, Time Magazine's latest issue has an image of one of the pink pussy hats that were sort of the uniform of the Women's March. And the headline reads, "The Resistance Rises, How a March Becomes a Movement." Politico ran a headline asking, will the Women's March end up becoming another Occupy or another Tea Party? Neither one of those sound like great choices to me, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on whether or not you do think the Women's March will end up having legs, so to speak.
I think it will. I think it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of organizing. It's going to take a lot of unity, which is not often the measure of progressive democratic forces. But I think it's going to be closer to the Tea Party. I think people are fixed on, you know, many women after that march went back to their communities, and even the day after the march, Kelly, women went to sessions learning how to run for office, for school boards, for city councils. And I think if you can take that and fuse it with primarying Democrats who are in cahoots with corporatists or, you know, Joe Manchin, who's going to be wobbly and wavering, I think you get some energy. But the key thing is that I think the resistance is going to be women-led. I think it's going to be affirmative. And I think it's going to be organized. Occupy was something different. But I think you're going to see spokes and spikes around this country, cities, communities, states, which came back from Washington. And there is a commitment. And there are lots of groups at work already. So I take solace in that.
How much is reproductive policy going to be part of the agenda, do you sense?
I think it'll be part of it, but I think what you see is a commitment to economic justice, racial justice, reproductive justice, but a broad kind of inclusive populism that links a reproductive rights to economic security so that it's not It's about families. It's about men, women, children, and it's about a new, you know, security. So I don't see this as a reproductive rights march, Kelly. I think it was the face of women. And it wasn't even anti-Trump. I mean, people may disagree with that, but it was really kind of pro-women in a broad and, I think, very affirmative way. And I think it showed that resistance matters. As I said earlier, resistance matters. It gave people a sense of solidarity. But I am the first or second to say it has to now move forward. You can't just keep doing crowd numbers. And, in fact, it could have been a smaller march, but you need the organizing moving forward.
The most important fact about that march was there was not a single arrest. I would say the less this looks like the traditional left in action, the less it looks like Occupy Wall Street and all of these agglomeration of boutique causes slung together, and the more it looks like the PTA, the more effective it will be.
All righty, we've reached that time.
A lot of those women are going to go run for the PTA.
Alrighty, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, we'll start with you.
I want to salute all the participants in Friday's aforementioned March for Life, an event that typically the media resoundingly ignores. Every year, the marchers demonstrate their faithfulness to a pro-life cause that has been scorned for decades, but that will stand the test of time and is now on the verge of major progress. Well done.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, what's your rant?
I want to call out California's Governor Jerry Brown, who laid down a direct challenge to Trump in his State of the State speech this past week. And what he did was interesting. It was sort of saying, laying down the challenge that the California dream would come to fill the emotional political space in this century that in the 20th century was the purview of the American dream. And he spoke on immigration and healthcare and climate, on a slew of issues which will, I think, inform the broader peaceful resistance that is needed across cities, states, and communities in this country.
David Frum, what's on your mind?
President Trump has demanded an investigation of misconduct in the 2016 election. I think this is a fantastic idea, and Congress should give it to him. And it should give it to him with a mandate to look into all kinds of wrongdoing, illegal voting, self-enrichment by candidates, interference in the election by foreign espionage agencies. And if you're asking, does a congressional investigative body have the power to subpoena tax records? Yes, it does.
Alrighty then. Well, for my rant, Madonna's crass remarks at the Women's March ended up stealing headlines that should have been focused on what was an overwhelmingly peaceful, positive, and important day. But even more frustrating, the negative headlines she generated came on the heels of negative headlines the march faced for excluding pro-life groups as partners. As I wrote in my column for the Daily Beast, I believe they should have been included. We need as many women as possible holding the current commander-in-chief accountable. And for the record, I have plenty of pro-life friends who have better manners than Madonna. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and David Frum. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Our production assistant is Katie Burskins. And I'm Kelly Goff. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
So if you like pajamas,
pajamas,
I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all. Let's call the whole thing off. Let's call the
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.